Hare Krishna. Very welcome to the temple today, Sunday, 8th of June. And Manu sent me an email. He said, would you like to come and speak? I said, thank you very much. I'm always honored to come and speak. And I said, I want to entitle this talk, Life's Highest Goal. Life's Highest Goal. So what is the highest goal in life? To get married? Have children? Get a job? Buy a house? Own a car? Immigrate to a better country? Start your own business? Make a lot of money? Or take a better birth, perhaps, in your next life? These are all common goals for many people. But are any of these life's highest goal? So we'll start today by speaking about these three concepts. Karma, vikarma, and akarma. So I think most of you here, we all know something about karma. Even people who don't know the word karma know something about karma. Because karma is action and reaction. Whatever you do, there will be a reaction. Whatever you sow, you will reap. Correct? Or we like to say, what goes around, comes around. We know this throughout the world, in any country, in any culture. I don't think there's anybody who doesn't believe in that concept. What some people have trouble with is, does it happen from lifetime to lifetime, or is it all encased in one single solitary lifetime? Oh my God forbid, I hope that's not the case. Well, it isn't the case. So karma takes place over a period of many lifetimes through reincarnation. So we're going to look at karma a little differently today than that. That's the common understanding of karma. But we're going to first talk about karma in terms of prescribed duties and actions which improve your karma. Prescribed duties. Doing the right thing. Acting out of honesty, integrity. Doing your duty. Doing your obligation. Whatever you're obliged to do. Taking care of your responsibilities. That is that concept of karma. Take it a step further, and we can say, acting in harmony with your own nature. Your own nature is your dharma. So doing your prescribed duty, doing the right thing, and also doing it in accord with your nature. So when we undergo or undertake karma in this sense, prescribed duty, we will generate a positive reaction. So our karma will improve. Now that means our lives could improve, even in this life and certainly in the next life. We could get a better birth than we did in this life, a better situation. We could also be promoted to the heavenly planets, the heavenly realms, where the degree of enjoyment and sense gratification is far beyond what's available here. So that will also sometimes be the result of good karma. What is vikarma? Vikarma is neglected or negative actions which generate negative karma, negative reaction. So vikarma means you're supposed to show up for work at 9 o'clock and you're supposed to work from 9 to 5, but you don't show up for work. You told them you'd be there. That was the arrangement. But you didn't. Is that an example of vikarma? Yeah. You're shirking your duty. You're neglecting your responsibility. You said you'd do it, but you're not doing it. That's vikarma. What else is vikarma? Cheating people, taking advantage of people, stealing, killing, ripping people off, criminal activities, destructive activity. Destructive activity toward others, that's vikarma. What about destructive activity toward self? Is that vikarma? Is it going to bring you positive results? Is it going to bring you positive karma down the line?
No.
No. So we can include the self. That's vikarma. The third one is akarma. When you put a before a word in Sanskrit, it means no, not. Akarma means no karma. Now we're getting closer. Akarma are actions offered to God. Here at the temple in Krishna consciousness, we look at God as Krishna. Do we not realize God might take the form of Allah or Yahweh? Different forms? Yes, we do. But we like Krishna because it's the most attractive form of God. So when actions are offered to Krishna, everything you do, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, whatever you give away, should be done as an offering unto me each day. Bhagavad Gita. Why? It generates no karma. Oh, wait a second. I want karma. I want good karma. As long as you generate positive karma or negative karma, you will do what? You will come back. Lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. Why? To enjoy or suffer the reactions to your karma. You will keep coming back. You will keep taking birth. So we are on the wheel of samsara, reincarnation, repeated birth and death. As long as we keep generating karma, we keep getting another body. You may say, well, I like getting another body. I like my body. You know, done okay with it so far. Yeah, maybe you got a good one this lifetime. Maybe you didn't. We don't want to continue to generate karma because we are subject to birth, old age, suffering, disease, and death repeatedly. Yet not one single person wants it. There's not a person in this room that wants to die unless they're depressed. Nobody wants to grow old, and no one wants disease. Yet we are subject to it. This is proof positive that this is not where we belong, my friends. This is not where we belong. We're caught in this wheel, this cycle of repeated birth and death. If we stop generating karma and give everything to God, then at the end of life, if there's no more karma, and two things, that's one thing, no more karma left to fulfill, left to play out, left to receive reactions from, and secondly, not one single material desire remaining. Not one. Well, actually, I have two. That's two too many. Not one. Well, what is a material desire? It's a desire connected to the body, to matter. Anything at the end of life, you go, oh, you know, my life's been pretty good, but there's just, oh, this one thing I really, really wanted to do. I just wish I could have done that. Hey, okay, you're back in. You're back in the lottery. You will get the next body so you can fulfill that one desire. Yes, my friends. So no karma, no desire. You are out of here. You get the get out of jail free card. And you go back to the spiritual world where you belong. That's where the souls belong. We're souls, aren't we? Yes, we are. But we're covered over by these physical bodies. What do you mean we're covered? They die, these bodies. They wear out. They die. Souls don't wear out. They don't die. They're eternal. So you must learn to identify with the soul rather than the body. Pretty simple. It's not complicated. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about vikarma. Here's an example. If a man takes up a weapon and decides to kill another man, he's considered to have transgressed the laws of karma, the laws of dharma, morality, the laws of God, and the laws of the state. Yes or no? He's broken them all, hasn't he? Yes, he has. He's going against his prescribed duty for his own self-interest. His prescribed duty is don't kill anybody. We all kind of know that, don't we? It really doesn't have to be pointed out. We have that feeling. Don't do that. He's gone against that. He's killed somebody for his own self-interest. Vikarma. Wrong action. And subsequently, he will be punished for it. Well, theoretically. In this life, he may be punished for it. If he gets away with it in this life, then he'll be punished for it later on. You can rest assured. Now, on the other hand, if a soldier takes up a weapon and kills an opposing soldier in battle, it is different. He is considered to have been acting under his prescribed duty. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Karma. Not vikarma, karma. Yet he has committed the same act. He killed somebody. But the circumstances are different, right? So he is not going to be punished for doing this exact same act. Context is different. Now in Bhagavad Gita, the whole conflict the problem at the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna was a warrior princess. Warrior prince. No offense, Arjuna. It's a slip. Arjuna did not, his duty was to fight to uphold and defend Dharma, defend morality, do the right thing. He's a Kshatriya. Kshatriya in Sanskrit means warrior, protector. He's the part of society that's meant to protect others. We have the police, we have the army, we have the government. They're supposed to protect the people. And if they don't do it, according to the Vedas, they're not entitled to tax you. Ooh, there's a revolutionary thought. They're not entitled to your tax money unless they protect you. From without, meaning criminals, and from within, meaning disease. take that to the ballot box. Nonetheless, so Arjuna, that was his job. But at the Battle of Kurukshetra, he found this duty to be personally too difficult, inconvenient, and distasteful. So right near the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, he drops his weapons. He says, I cannot fight. Lucky for him, he had Krishna driving his chariot. At the time, Krishna said, I am not fighting. I choose not to fight, but I will drive your chariot. So this was Krishna's opportunity to explain Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. And Bhagavad Gita is the science of yoga, the science of dharma, the science of karma, the science of duty. So Krishna was encouraging Arjuna to stand up, take up his weapons, and do his duty. Why? To kill people? No. Would he ultimately kill people? Yeah. Is that why he told him to do it? No. He told him to do it because it was his duty. And that's why he'd come there. To fight a just war on just principles. And it was his duty as a warrior to do just that. And he was neglecting his duty. So what was he performing? Vikarma. I choose not to fight. It's inconvenient. No. You know, tell your boss who wants you in at 7 o'clock every morning that that's inconvenient. I like to get a good bit of a lay-in in the morning. Bit of a sleep. I'll be in at 10. See how that works. It won't work. Unless you're the linchpin of the entire company. Maybe then, but... Right? So, that's what the whole Bhagavad Gita is about. Simply doing your duty. Continuing with Vikarma, Nunam Pramatta Kurite Vikarma, Yad Indriya Pritaya Aprinoti, Nasadu Manye Yata Atmano Yamma Sannapi Kleshada Asadeha. This is a verse from the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. For those of you who don't know, that is Sanskrit. And this is Rishabhdev, who is a king. He's speaking to his son. And this is the translation of that verse. When a person considers sense gratification, to enjoy himself, as the aim of life, he certainly becomes mad after materialistic living and engages in all kinds of sinful activity. Nunam pramatta kurite vikarma. Kurute, he performs vikarma. Wrong action. Negative action. Neglecting his duty. And such a man is pramatta. He's maddened. He becomes a little crazy. Because he's running around desperately after sense enjoyment, no matter what. Now, we could look at certain people in the material world and say, oh yeah, well, I can see that person's an example of that, and that person may be an example of that, and this person's addicted to this person's addicted to that, and that's clearly an example. That's true on one level. But it actually refers to all of us as a collective. If we think we are these bodies, and our highest goal of life is simply to enjoy ourselves while neglecting the needs of the soul, the eternal part of the self. Prabhupada says, somebody like this is like the monkey. He is performing so many activities without any real meaning. Leaping around like a mad monkey, running here and there, like mad people chasing our tails, fulfilling our imaginary program. We all have this program. You have your program and your plan and your desire, whatever it might be. which is manufactured out of your mind and your desire. But then the question comes, is it the best thing for you, ultimately? Oftentimes we do not know what is the best thing for us. So that's what, why we turn to an authority like sadhus, saints, sages, munis, acharyas, gurus, people with experience, people who have thought about these things for many years, and also the Vedas. The Vedas are the oldest books of knowledge, and in spirituality, the oldest tradition on the planet. There's nothing older. I'm not saying that because I read it. I'm saying it because I researched it thoroughly. I looked for years. There's nothing older. And nothing of the same depth that you will find in the Vedas. This whole tradition here comes from the Vedas. I rarely get through all these notes. Okay. Akarma. With a body, you can enjoy full facility here in the material world through your five senses. That's the nice thing about a body. You can see a beautiful woman or an attractive man. You can watch a football match. You can touch soft things. You can eat delicious food. You can smell the flowers. You can listen to beautiful music, or you can enjoy sexual congress. You can do all these things with the body. But sooner or later, you'll reach a level of satiation. Any single thing you'll only do for a time, and no matter what it is and how wonderful it is and how much you like it, you'll say, enough. That's enough. No more. Maybe another time. No more. Which is a simple proof that we can only enjoy ourselves sensually through the body, through matter, temporarily. Because it's not spirit. The enjoyment that comes from identification with soul, with spirit, with the spiritual realm, is not temporary. It's eternal. There is no law of satiation. In fact, it's quite the opposite. There's only one law, and that's increase. It increases. It expands. Things increase and expand here too. Since we were small, we grew up. That's increase and expansion. But it reaches a point and then it begins to dwindle. Even at 21, essentially the growing process, maybe 18, is over. And you're on the road, slow road to death. It's a fact. You know. That's the reality in the material world. So you reach the point of satiation. All of these things that you are doing through sense gratification are being done for your own satisfaction, your own ego, your own enjoyment. Because you are the occupier of the body. Hey, it's my body. I'll do with it what I want. It's my body. You hear that a lot nowadays in different contexts. It is your body for a time, but it is not actually your body. It belongs to God. It's a gift. He gave it to you. Yes or no? It's a gift. So if you are busy in your body, enjoying what you're enjoying, and you do not recognize its source, where it came from, who gave it to you, who blessed you with your body and your ability to enjoy, then you are, in a sense, a thief, simply because you're not recognizing. There's a need to recognize everything. Oftentimes, atheists will say, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in any higher source, I don't believe in a higher power, I don't believe in spirit. Where yet we have the wherewithal here on planet Earth. We have earth, we have water, we have fire, we have air, we have ether, the five major elements. In all the things these comprise, with which we can take and mold and manipulate and manufacture all so many wonderful things. Well, how did they get here to begin with? How can you not recognize that all this is put here for you? To sustain life, at the very least, to sustain your life. So you can eat and shelter yourself and clothe yourself. So one must realize the source. And that's God. That's Krishna. And you must recognize God in this, and therefore you must give him his due. Is he a real complex God, and he's highly demanding, and he's kind of a curmudgeon, and it's real hard to please this guy? No. No. Quite the opposite. Krishna, his own words in Bhagavad Gita are, Patram pushpam palam toyam, yo me bhaktya prayachiti, tadaham bhakti bharitam ashnami prayatatmanaha. If one offers with love and devotion to me a leaf, a flower, a piece of fruit, or water, I will accept it. Wow. Why didn't he say a pot of gold? Well, not everybody has a pot of gold they can offer. But you have a leaf. You have a flower. You can get one if you don't have one. Piece of fruit, some water. That's all. It's so simple. And with a little devotion, a little appreciation, thank you. Thank you for giving me this. Thank you for this facility. A little recognition. No? If you give somebody a gift for a birthday, for Christmas, whatever, right? And the next time you go over to their house, maybe 6 months later, year later, and you see the gift is in the box up on the shelf inside the closet, what do you feel? I gave him this gift. He's not even using it. He's not appreciating it. What do you think about the next time his birthday rolls around? You give him a leaf or a flower, maybe. Right? Suppose you come over to his house 6 months later, after you have given the gift, and you walk in, there he is. He's busy with this gift, or he's wearing it, or something, and he's, wow, this thing's just great. Thank you so much for giving me that gift. How do you feel? Didn't I give the right gift to the right person? It makes you, that's what the whole concept of giving makes you feel better than receiving. It's true. When? Anytime? When it's appreciated. Right? You think God is different? He's not. He's no different than you. Or shall I say, you're no different than he. A little appreciation, my friends, goes a long way. Thank you for this body. Many of you are very, very attractive people. You scored. Good karma. Everybody's got something to be thankful for. Everybody. All of us. So, offer to God with gratitude, with thanks, a little bit of love, if you can muster a little love, then you begin to follow God's program, not just your program. Now, you may be a wonderful person of great talent and ability, but nonetheless, you are limited. You're limited. God is unlimited. So, can you imagine if God's driving your chariot? What is possible for you? Your little limited world just expanded. That's how it works. You don't believe me? Fine. Test it out first. Test it out. See if it doesn't work. Okay? So what are we talking about here? Akarma. Well, can I still do the things that I do? You can. As long as they're not vikarma, correct? You can still do what you do, but you're offering it to God. First, I'm doing this for you. I'm a singer in a band. Fine. Sing for God. Offer it to Him, then go on stage and sing your heart out. That's all. Well, I got a job in a factory. I don't really like it that much, but it pays me. Okay. Before you start working, offer it to God. You just spent 8 hours and you generated no karma. Really? Yes. How easy is it? It's so simple. Any of us can do it. A child can learn to do it. Okay, here's an example. If you occupy a rented house or an apartment where you currently live, it does not make you the owner, does it? No. You're the occupier, just like you are the occupier of this body. You say it's your body, but actually it isn't. It belongs to God. You're renting for a time. Lifelong lease. The owner is another person entirely who has given you permission to occupy the house for a limited period of time, correct? And when there's an agreement, you've signed it, right? That's an example. Here's another example. At home, you're the boss, okay? You're in charge. Maybe you're in charge of the family. But then you go to work. At the office, the factory, wherever you work, now you're no longer the boss. Right? Here, you must work for the sole satisfaction of the proprietor. If you work for your own satisfaction, the proprietor will kindly ask you to leave and find another job. I can assure you. As you all know. So, again, you know, give unto God what is God's. What did Jesus say in the Bible? New Testament? Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Give unto God what is God's. So, if you work according to your own plan and ignore God, your own program, then you'll suffer or enjoy the fruits of your failures and your successes. You'll take on the karma. So in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, Krishna says, yagyartat karmano nyatra loko yam karma vandanaha. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu, for God, for Krishna, must be performed. Otherwise, work causes bondage in the material world. This whole thing about karma, vikarma, action, reaction, that is bondage. Because it compels you to come back and take another birth. You are compelled. That's bondage. Yet we all want to be free, don't we? Do you have this feeling way, way down deep in your heart? I had it since I was a child. I just want to be free. I want to be free. What do you mean, free? I don't know. I just want to be free. From what? For everything. I want to be free to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, to go where I want to go. Do you ever have that feeling? The ultimate freedom is don't die. Don't buy into this whole death business. Don't buy into it. It's not the truth. We all buy into it. We all accept it. It's not the truth. We're eternal. Yet we all buy into it. Hook, line, and sinker. That's not what we're meant to be. We have to lift ourselves out of it no matter how it appears all around us. Is that easy to do? Frankly, no. It isn't easy to do. Because we're surrounded by it. It's three-dimensional, isn't it? To anybody here that doesn't know somebody who died? You know? No. So, when we do everything as a sacrifice, what does sacrifice mean? Well, to give something up, to make a sacrifice, to let something go. Yeah, that's a concept, but that's not actually what the word means. It comes from Latin, sacer and facere. Facere means to do, to make, and sacer means sacred. To make sacred. That's what it means. Make what sacred? Everything in your life, make it sacred. How do I make it sacred? I'm not a priest. I don't walk around with a rosary. You offer it to God. That's how you do it. That makes it sacred. What does that mean then? It generates no karma. No, it can't be that simple. It is. It's that simple. Wonderful, isn't it? I love when this complex philosophy is just reduced to its most simple. I start feeling free inside. I like that feeling. Okay, now I'm going to touch on our friend Bhaktivinoda Thakur, whose mind is absolutely brilliant, who's an acharya, teacher in our line. Prabhupada's guru is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and his guru, his father, was Bhaktivinoda. He was a high court judge in Bengal, in Orissa actually, in Puri. And he's very good at kind of analyzing things and laying them out in a very simplified format. So he's talking now about spiritual evolution. And he gives the five levels of spiritual evolution. Number one, uncivilized people. What would that be? Tribal people, people who live in the jungle, perhaps, you know, earth-based cultures. They don't have a polish. Doesn't mean they don't have validity, it just means they don't have perhaps an organized society quite the same way. I know some of them did. The next level, civilized, where we have a functional society, we go about our business, we don't have to worry about somebody. Well, I was going to say we don't have to worry about somebody walking up to us and stealing and killing us, but on the other hand, sometimes we do, I guess, but that's the theory behind civilized society. You can walk up and down the street, you'd be okay, you know. Just don't go to the wrong neighborhood. And the next level is a scientific level. You start to analyze things. What makes it tick, you know? How can we use greater science to propel ourselves forward in a civilized world? The next level, number four, is moral. The moral level, dharma. Again, doing the right thing. And the fifth level, which is life's highest purpose, is devotional. Get devotional. So the process of worshiping God also changes with these various states of evolution through language, dress, food, mental attitude. Each level serves its purpose through the gradual evolutionary process. Well, what's he talking about? Darwinian evolution? No. No. Not Darwinian evolution. Not whether the platypus is happy with his extra extended flippers in the Galapagos. No. He's talking about spiritual evolution. Evolution in consciousness. As we grow through these different stages. A soul goes through various levels of advancement from animal life to civilized life. You mean we were animals? Yes. There are 8,400,000 species in the universe according to the Vedas. 400,000 of those species are human. You've never met 400,000 different human species, my friends, unless you've traveled to other planets, and you can tell me about that later. But there is no 400,000 species of humans on this planet. But they exist. And the 8 million, well, you know who that is. That's everybody else. From the amoeba upward. So we have, to get to the human form of life is the greatest gift. And it isn't just given that easily. We would have had to have gone through countless births, thousands probably, in various species. You don't have to go through every single one of them, but you have to go through a lot to get up to the human form of life. Because only in the human form of life are you able to have the cognizance and the discretion, the intellectual capacity to get off of the wheel of birth and death. Can an animal do that? No. A dog acts like a dog. You never see a dog act like a cat, ever. A human can act like a human. We could act like a dog if we want. Correct? Or we can act like a god, like a divine being if we choose. Animals can only act according to their instinct, right? But we have a choice. So that's why this form of life is of such great value. So he goes from animal to civilized life to godless moral life. Godless moral life. There are many atheists who do not believe in God. But they may be moral people. They may be good people. They may help others. They may be charitable. They may have been benevolent or philanthropic. Yet they don't believe in God. To moral life with an imaginary conception of God. What does that mean? Well, I've talked to many people. I spent 25 years in California, in Los Angeles, which probably was the most important part of my formation in my lifetime, to be honest. And so I met a lot of very spiritual people there, because there's a lot of really spiritual people in California. Believe it or not. And a lot of times this is what you hear. I follow my own path. I follow my own method. I don't sign on to any religion or any method. I just follow my own method. So, according to the Vedas, dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. That dharma, or spiritual practice, morality, cannot be manufactured by anybody. It's bhagavat pranitam. It is inculcated or presented or established by God. Only God can establish this. So therefore we look for an authority, something beyond ourselves, beyond the imaginings of the mind. Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that typically those who are proud or who are chasing fame and renown try to manufacture or discover new paths of spirituality. So he says it's actually a result of pride. And those who have good fortune, sukriti. Sukriti means good karma, good fortune from past life. You have sukriti. I'll tell you right now, my friends, the fact that all of you are sitting here, you all have sukriti. You wouldn't be sitting here. You'd have no interest in this whatsoever if you didn't have this sukriti, this good fortune. You'd be busy doing other things. So those who have good fortune or sukriti from past lives tend to give up their pride. They respect the path established by the acharyas, by the teachers, by the older traditions, the established traditions. And here it's from the Vedas. So, sometimes people say, thinking again of the theme, a life's highest goal, people in more material or mundane consciousness, they say, the most important thing is family. How many times have you heard that? Numerous times. Right? So my answer is, my question is, what family? One you're in now? The one you had in lifetime 462? That one? The one you had in lifetime 139? Or the one you had last life? Which family? This one. This family right now. Why? Why is it the most important thing? I'm not saying family is not important. I'm not saying your responsibility to your family is not important. A family is not the most important thing. That is not the highest goal in life. And if you think so, you will be back again with your new family in your next life. You must understand that a lifetime in our world is just like a bubble sitting, appearing upon the surface of the ocean. You ever seen a bubble on the surface of the ocean? Of course you have. There it is. It's kind of moving around. There you go. And all of a sudden, gone. Gone. Never to return. That's your life. Blink of an eye. It's not the most important thing. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in answer to that statement, Prabhupada has quoted this verse countless times. Yasyat mabudhi kuna petri datu ke. Svadhi kalatradishu bhauma idjadi. What does that mean? One who is in atma buddhi, consciousness of the self as being the body, kunape, this kunape tridhatu, made up of the three dhatus. The kunape is the cadaver. This is the cadaver. This is the corpse. It's made up of tridhatu. Kapha, pitta, vata. Three constitutions according to Ayurveda. Mucus, bile, air. And if you think that is the main identity, which we do because we're related to the body rather than the soul, Swadhi, then in addition to that, Swadhi, his mentality of the self, Kalatradishu, beginning with the wife and children, with the spouse and the children. That's his identification. These are mine. This is me. These are mine. This is my spouse, my children. Yeah. And the Bauma Ijadi. He has the mentality that his Bauma, Bauma comes from what? What is the root of Bauma, root word? Bhumi, earth, his Bauma, his land of birth. The land of birth is Ija, worshipable. Delusion. Oh, I'm so proud to be Irish, don't you know? Irish is fine, but it's a temporary identification. And this one's proud to be American, and this one's proud to be Mauritian, or this one's proud to be French, or, you know, make your list. Worshipping the land of birth. Should you respect your land of birth? Respect? Yeah, we respect. We don't disrespect. Your identity here is so transitory. And then it's gone. And then the end of that verse says, Janeshva Vigyeshu Sa Eva Gokara. He's no better than a jackass. If that's what he thinks, he thinks like a jackass. That's actually what it says. No offense. Because you're looking at it in too limited a manner. Your soul. Your soul. The body's temporary. Your identity. As a woman, as a man, as white, as black, as brown, as green, it's temporary. As a particular ethnicity, it's temporary. Don't trip over these things. Don't get hung up over these things. Because before you know it, you'll be the ethnicity or the skin color that you hate the most. When you see other people carrying it around, you'll get stuck in that body to see what's like on the receiving end. Ooh, I never thought of that. You better think now. Okay. So, what's life's highest purpose? Well, we established it's a karma. Offer it to God. What is it? Anything. Everything. All of it. In the yoga system, the practice of yoga, many people who do yoga, I don't mean hot yoga and Vikram yoga and aerobic yoga. No. This is not yoga. Yoga means people who meditate, and yoga means to join with God, to join with the spirit. So traditionally, yogis who practice Ashtanga Yoga, which is the pranayama, breathing, and then all the asanas that you go to the yoga class for practicing asanas, but you might do that to stay more fit and to lose some weight, which is not really the purpose of yoga, but that's okay. It does have those side benefits. But traditionally, yogis practice the yoga process, that type of process, for what? To develop yoga siddhis. What are yoga siddhis? Powers. Powerful powers. Mystical powers. That's traditionally why they do it. Will it produce that? Yeah. Oh yeah. But you gotta get real serious about it, you know. Very serious. The jnanis are those who pursue knowledge, you know, more philosophically oriented, but jnana is also a system of yoga. And the jnanis, their focus is on liberation, getting off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death. That's their focus. Well, I already mentioned that, and I already encouraged you along those lines. Oh, well then we've arrived. That must be the highest goal of life. No, it's not. Because the process that we follow here is also yoga. But it's bhakti. It's not just physical drilling and physical exercise, like the yogis do. It's not just philosophical understanding, philosophical development, and mental speculation about what God is and what is the truth in the greater scheme of things. But it brings in the heart. What about the heart? Isn't that an important component in your body? Absolutely. And when you open the heart, then love develops. You know what it's like when you fall in love? Have you ever fallen in love? Anybody? Not a soul here. That's very unusual. One man. You get crazy. You get stupid. You just think of her all the time. Huh? I eat, sleep, and think about her. You know. Can't wait to see her. I think I'll text her now. You just texted her. Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Right? Walking 2 inches off the ground. Skipping down the street, you're singing all those corny songs. Yeah. I'm in love. We like love, don't we? That's wonderful. It's wonderful. So that's how you feel when you love another person. What's it like if you raise that up a notch or two and learn to love God? What would that be like? This other person may be an absolutely wonderful person. I will not take that away from you. And that may be well deserving of your love. But they are a limited soul. If you develop your love for God, that guy's unlimited. What's possible then, I wonder? That's life's highest goal. That's the one. That's what we do here. What do you mean we do it? Well, we practice it. We work at it. We try to blow that heart open a little bit more each time, you know? A little more compassion. A little more empathy. A little more joy. Joy comes. You like joy? Well, I love joy. Wonderful. That's what we do. So how do we do that? Well, Vaidhi Bhakti. Vaidhi Bhakti means we have practices. There's certain things we do. We chant Hare Krishna. Names of God. Names of God are non-different than God. The children, little children, they chant Hare Krishna. You saw them. Simple. Very easy to do. Anybody can do it. What does it do? It purifies the heart. these impressions and imprints we've gathered in the subconscious over a period of how many lifetimes? Who can count? That's what it does. We take prasadam, or food offered to God. We only eat food after we've offered it to God, and it becomes prasadam. Prasadam means mercy. It's purifying. Is it actually purifying? Oh yeah, I've seen it with my own eyes many times. Over time, it's purifying. It actually removes your negative karma. Chanting Hare Krishna will burn up your negative karma. Eating prasadam will burn your negative karma. Offering things to God, like we've discussed, will burn negative karma. No. Yeah. It can't be that easy. It's that easy. It's that easy. So that's why we invite you to do it. Then, you know, you in the process of doing various practices, as mentioned, we will develop some faith, some belief. Why? Because we get a taste. Krishna reciprocates with you. Believe me, he does. He does. I wouldn't be sitting here 42 years later since he's knocked at my door in the form of a spiritual sky incense packet. It all went from there. 42 years ago. He reciprocates. I'm still there. Still trying to get a little closer, a little closer. So when you've practiced long enough, you begin to develop that taste and you begin to become spontaneously attracted to God. Just like you are spontaneously attracted to your love, right? When you fall in love, your love becomes the center of your universe, at least for a time, right? But not just for a time with God, with Krishna, but forever. That's our goal. And then that's called Raganuga Bhakti. How do you gain this? Intense longing, ardent desire, ardent longing. You gotta yearn. You gotta yearn for it. Like you yearn for your love when you fall in love. Do you not yearn? Oh, if only I could see her. If only I could be with her. Just a few minutes. I'm gonna FaceTime her right now. I'm gonna Skype her. Look at her face. She's working. I can't do it. Right? I just want to hear your voice. Hi. Gotta go. Bye. It's your boss coming. Ardent longing to be with God. What is that called? Laulyam. Laulyam. By developing an ardent longing for serving Krishna, serving the devotees who help Krishna, serve Krishna, chanting the holy names, our desire and lust for inferior things, material things, will diminish. Really? Yeah. Automatically, it'll diminish. It will. Trust me. This ardent longing is the qualification for raga bhakti, spontaneous love for God. Love, loving devotion. And the three keys, these are the three keys. Prayer. Talk to God. What's prayer? Talk to Him. Tell Him. Don't just ask for stuff. You can ask for stuff if you want, but don't just ask for stuff. Talk to Him. When you meet up with your friends, you just ask them for stuff? No, you don't. You talk to them. All right? Same with God. He likes it when you talk to Him. Prayer. Number two, humility. Humility. Is this important? Oh, extremely important. Extremely important. You must become humble. You must not indulge your sense of ego or your self-importance. That's the beginning of the end, believe me. You see this in life, in all kinds of ways, do you not? Just in regular life. When people get a little too puffed up, a little too arrogant, and down they come. Everybody goes, yeah, good friend. Right? Well, some of us do, some of us don't. No, humility. Very important. No matter how powerful, no matter how wonderful, no matter how successful you are, how intelligent you are, how famous you are, be humble. Be humble always in the eyes of God. Always. And the third one? Ardent longing. Yearn for God in your life. That's life's highest goal. Thank you. Thank you. Do we have any questions?